Hello, everyone. Here we are with another episode of Sales Effectiveness Radio. I'm really happy today to welcome a couple guests from Sales Globe. I have Mark DiNolo, who is the managing director, and Michelle Seeger, who is responsible for sales strategy and change management within the practice. So thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate your taking the time out of your schedule to be with us. And what I'd like to start with is kind of just getting to know Sales Globe a little bit more. Mark, tell me a little bit about what Sales Globe does.
Well, thanks, Steve. Sales Globe, we like to think of ourselves as a sales innovation firm. So what we do is we solve problems for companies around their sales organizations and around growth. And what does that mean? Well, that means that we usually look at everything as a problem statement or a challenge question to solve, which we take apart and we use a design thinking process to get into some practical areas like sales strategy, sales organization design, sales compensation and quotas, so how you pay your organization. And then we get into change management as well. So how do you actually make that change? How do you get beyond the recommendation and the PowerPoint to really make it work within the organization? So that's a big focus area for us, is getting the results from that.
So that sounds like a pretty comprehensive approach to a sales organization. It sounds like you've got your fingers in all sorts of pies.
I think we do, and it really comes from an issues-based approach. So when companies come to us, it's kind of like the doctor, right? They don't say, hey, I need a sales compensation program. They say, hey, you know, it hurts here. What do I do about this? And so you find yourself going in different directions to solve those problems.
Well, that's great, because I find a lot of people do come with the I need and they don't really know what they need.
Right. And that's the first place you start, is, well, let's not assume that really is what they need. So the whole idea of design thinking or sales innovation would be to redefine that problem. So let's not take the problem statement as fact, but let's understand the story behind that and then determine what they really need. And a lot of times it's something different, or they'll come to you with certain words or certain language that you'll interpret. And so it may be, we need help with our sales strategy. And you know what sales strategy means to you, and you immediately right. interpret that and start to go after that. Well, that may not be the right answer. What does sales strategy mean to you? What's the pain? What does it feel like, and what are you trying to really solve for?
So a lot of digging into those issues, because I've gone to the doctor and said, I need an MRI, and he goes, slow down.
Yeah, yeah. Who's got the MD here?
Yeah, tell me a little bit more. And so that sounds like that is part of what you have to do there, is dig in and find out the real underlying issues before you can actually start to solve the problem.
Right, and I think that's where a lot of companies make their first mistake, and a lot of sales organizations make their first mistake talking about sales and customers, is listening to what the customer says and answering that customer's question. Yes, we want to listen to what the customer says, but we want to make sure we're answering the right question. So one jump you can get on your competitors, thinking about people in sales organizations, is understanding what the true root problem is, or the root challenge is, and solving for that, not solving for just the words that come out of their mouth.
Yeah, it's a saying that I came up with a long time ago. It's about customer requirements, because you can never tell the customer that their requirements don't matter. So I say, we care, but not that much, because we really do have to figure out why they have those requirements, why they're expressing the particular need or want before we really, because we can prescribe, or we can go ahead and do what they're asking for, but if it doesn't work, who gets blamed?
Well, we do.
Right.
We're holding the bag. And so one of the big dilemmas is self-diagnosis. So I was in a company before, and we had a problem that sounded like this, and here's what we did, and it worked. Well, okay, that's kind of like diagnosing your own appendix. Well,
right.
It may not be actually what's wrong.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So obviously what goes along with that is the change management, or any kind of the evolution within that organization as they adopt new ideas, new methodologies, new processes, new compensation plans, whatever it happens to be. And we all know that change is a slow and sometimes painful process. So, Michelle, how does Sales Globe help with that? How do you get a customer through that?
Yeah, so every company is a little bit different. It really starts with, at the very beginning, making sure that when we understand that we've been brought in to make a change at a company, making sure that you got the buy-in of the executive team, and that you start at the very beginning to get their buy-in on communications. It really just starts with very clear communications on what you're doing and why, and the benefit to the individual. So there's always a benefit to the company, but you always need to turn that around and say, and what is the benefit for the individual as well?
And does that what's the success ratio with that? Because we all know that even if that, you know, there's logical and cognitive recognition of the value of change, but then there's that whole emotional stuff that gets in the way about, you know, I'm being disrupted. The job I used to have may not be there anymore, or I'm being asked to do more. The major motto in America, do more with less. So we're going to take, you know, three jobs and pile it on your plate. So isn't change wonderful?
Right. So if I'm actually managing that project, the success rate is about 100%.
Great.
But that was the reality is not just by asking for it, though.
Right.
Yeah. Right. That was to be a joke.
I know.
But anyway, so you bring up a really big point. And most of the work that we do in the projects we do, it's really not a head cutting or even a cost cutting mm-hmm. exercise. It's really a growth exercise. Companies are asking, how do they grow? How do they grow their footprint? How do they grow their revenue? How do they grow their profit? And it's not necessarily, and in many cases it's not, how do we cut our costs, right? Okay. But really, how do we grow? So getting the organization to understand that. We're doing business. We do a lot of global business, and we've got a multi-billion dollar company that we're doing a sales transformation for right now. They are number one in their space. They've grown by acquisition a lot. They pretty much dominate that space now. They've got almost 2,000. The plan is to have 2,000 salespeople feet on the street, right? So they're saying, like, what now?
Right.
And what we have determined is that in this particular client, they're not getting deep in their clients, right? So they own the market, but they're not deep anywhere, right? And so what we're doing is we're actually taking accounts away from salespeople where they're not penetrating, and we're showing them how they're going to earn more or as much as they did before.
Right.
That's challenging because the minute you take away something, even if you haven't seen that client in 5 years, they think it's, you know, going to go down. So all that to say, it gets down to one of my least favorite things, but one of the most important things to company: data analytics,
sure.
Right? The proof source. So even me being a people person, the way you get the buy-in is by showing people the money and showing people the story and building the scenario and helping them understand how they're really going to get there.
So that kind of ties back into what Mark was saying about compensation planning and
right.
quota setting and it sounds like territory assignments, account assignments.
Yeah.
And then along with that, does the expectation of performance get redesigned as well? Because if I'm expected to do more with fewer clients or fewer accounts in my territory, how do you bridge that gap to help them do that?
Well, it all fits together. We call it the mm-hmm. revenue roadmap, Steve. Yep. So basically what that says is you've got four big layers in the organization, or competency layers, insight into what's happening in the market. So insight is a good mm-hmm. example that you brought up, Michelle, about, well, we're not highly penetrated. So we have insight into our market, our performance, competitors. You've got the strategy layer, which is, okay, our strategy to go to market is going to shift because of that. The coverage layer, okay, so our roles are going to shift a bit and our territories are going to shift a bit. And then you've got the enablement layer, which has compensation, quotas, training and development, technology, et cetera. So all these things have to fit together. So
right.
if we're going to take something like the observation we made in that company that Michelle described, and we're going to adjust territories, well, we have to adjust how those roles are going to work. So it's not just enough to say, well, we're going to take your territory from 50 accounts down to 20 accounts and we want you to penetrate more. We have to help you understand how to penetrate more.
Yeah.
We have to give you a value proposition to do that, to get into additional buying points. Then we also, of course, have to adjust how the goals are going to work and the compensation mm-hmm. works. And contrarian thing that happens here is when you reduce territory size, usually you're not reducing the quota, because the territory will tend to produce more. So you may actually be mm-hmm. increasing the quota, and that's been proven in company after company.
Okay.
So counterintuitive to a lot of reps, but again, back right. to change management, you have to communicate, you got to give them that proof source for why that's really the
right.
truth.
Yep.
So the change management functions got to be more than just organizational or compensation, or operational. It's got to be at the person level to get them to change their behavior, their outlook, their sense of responsibility, all of those sorts of things.
It does. And what you need to do is take them along that journey and then tell them, not only explain the expectation, but then how you're going to get there and how you're going to get them there. And then it becomes a choice, right? So some people maybe, choice or not, can't make the shift.
Sure.
You know, and so you got to figure out what to do. Some people are really good, and the most, they're good, but maybe not in a particular role you have them in. And so companies have to be bold, and many times they're not, which is what leads to lack of revenue and profit and sales. And anyway, so what does right. that mean by being bold? Well, what am I going to do with these people, right? Do we retrain, redeploy, exit? You know, sometimes it's the last. But taking people down the road, helping them understand the change, and then where they fit in the context, and then it becomes, you know, again, the personal choice of the individual, the company choice to be bold, but support them along the journey. Yep.
Yeah, you hit a trigger for me, because being bold is one of my favorite yeah. sayings, you know, to inspire people to do things they might not feel they have the courage yeah. to do right now, and to help instill that courage so they can be bold. But it seems like the how they will be bold might be tied into their culture, because you mentioned three different yeah. alternatives in their boldness that might not be perceived as equally as well amongst those people who are being bold too.
You're right.
Yeah.
And so we see that a lot of times. So one of the first things that we want to do when we go into consult with an organization is to really understand their culture. We always start every initiative. I don't care if it's compensation, or we're looking at new organizational design, or something very tactical like segmentation of their business. Mm-hmm. We go in and we interview people, and we go in and talk to them, and we really get deep into understanding the culture. And that actually sets the stage for how we approach the change management and how we approach the project. So every single one is different, because at the end of the day, in the business that we do with sales, at the end of the day, I don't care how much enablement, how much technology, how many tools, how much AI is out there. At the end of the day, there are people at the end of the process somewhere right. and throughout that process. So even if you've automated, you need to be thinking about that. And so that's how we, you know, that tailored approach is what gets you the buy-in.
So, because people are squishy, right?
They're
hard to predict, and you can model their yeah. behavior, but they can go against their model.
You know, on that boldness point too, just mm-hmm. to add in, I think that's a really important point, because it's not just about changing the organization. It's about asking the leadership team,
yes.
what's your level of commitment to change? And that's cultural, but the question we'll usually ask is, what are you willing to do to make this change happen? How important is this change? And it can even get to the level of, what level of damage are you willing to sustain mm-hmm. to make this happen if it's important enough? Mm-hmm. Are you going to be able to handle any broken glass that happens to make this change happen?
And what do you find the responses to be? I'm sure they're varied, but
it's varied. It's cultural, but I think you have to lay that question out, because if not, the organization, the leadership team will just kind of operate in its normal mode. But if we say, well, we looked at the numbers, and we know that the trend is that quota attainment is declining over time, and pretty soon the company's attainment is going to be declining, and there's going to be a point where it's going to be a much bigger problem to solve. And so you get into motivators of change, mm-hmm. right? And the biggest motivator of change is avoidance of short-term pain versus long-term aspiration, like, we're going to be great in the future. Well,
right.
But if we see something coming that we have to avoid, that's a big motivator, and that can get people's commitment. So I think looking at those motivators can help us to figure out that level of commitment.
Have right. What's your experience, either of you, in the living to the commitments that get made? Because asking for the commitment is one thing, and getting it, I suspect you have a pretty high hit rate of people saying the right words in making that commitment. What happens down the road? Do they live to it, or how do you make sure they do?
So it depends. I hate to use that. It depends.
Oh, sure.
But it all starts again with the leadership and what they've done. So we tend to have a lot of repeat business. So we have an opportunity to go in and kind of audit and look at what's happened
go.
For changes that have been made. So we do, and we also do counsel and work with senior executives that we've worked with, so we can go back and see. And what we find is that leaders that stand behind what they're going to do, and they can affect the change that they need, but we may go back and we find out that some of the leadership team may have gone, ones that couldn't take it, you know, along the journey.
Right.
And it's no surprise, right? I mean, so it has to be the leadership. Other companies, we have found that they've gone so far and haven't gone as far as they need to go because, you know, we do a lot of, I'll give another story example. We do a lot of M&A work. And when you've got a company that may have grown up with a family and they treat everyone as if they were part of the family, that becomes very difficult, especially when you're talking about multi-billion-dollar companies that are now like having to go to the next stage, and maybe a lot of the people just don't belong anymore. That's tough, you know, and so we do find that it's a mixed bag. Some make it and some don't. I guess it depends at the end of the day, how much do they really want to get to that goal? Sometimes it's not a choice because maybe they've been acquired and they're forced, right? But other times they make the bold decision. And when you make the bold decision, what we find is that you bring along more people because you actually can find a better place for them than maybe a place where they didn't belong.
And in the absence of historical leadership, the when people exhibit it, you tend to get more followers.
You do. That's right. So it's – go ahead, Mark.
Well, so we looked at this question. You're talking about the leadership. We looked at this question of change a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And cultural change and sustainable change, and we found that there were three points that really made a difference. Mm-hmm. And one we're talking about, which is leadership, which is the message. Yeah. We are going to change. This is what we're going to do culturally. The other thing was what we measure. So mm-hmm. you go all the way down to the bottom of what we call the revenue roadmap. So what we're measuring, what we're paying for, so that will help sustain change. And in the middle layer, which was really important, was demonstration of that change. Mm-hmm. So if you can find people in the organization to demonstrate to their peers what that change looks like. Mm-hmm. So if you say, going back to the example Michelle was using, we're going to do a better job of penetrating accounts. We're going to be selling a full portfolio of our offerings. If people are showing how that's done and they're being successful, then I go, well, I can do that.
Right.
So you take it out of the abstract and you put it into the reality, and I can start to emulate those behaviors.
Becomes more practical.
It becomes more practical. And when they see the success, they start to ask for it, right? Because the idea is we've built a better model for you, whether it's a better lifestyle because you're working 80 hours now trying to hit these 50 accounts, or you can really focus on the accounts that really matter to you, whatever that thing is at the end of the day. The benefit is realized and demonstrated.
And the other wonderful thing about sales organizations is they like to compete.
Yes.
So when they see one of their peers doing well, they want to be able to do that also.
That's right.
Yeah, we like competitors. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a phenomenal backstory in how you do what you do. You know, as I was preparing for today's show, I noticed in Mark's bio it says Closet Art School MBA. Mm-hmm. Which intrigued me, and you know, and looking into some of the other information that you guys sent me, you know, the whole notion of design thinking when it comes to the sales organization. Tell me a little bit about what's going on there, Mark.
Well, the whole Closet Art School MBA thing—it was very painful at first, Steve, many, many years ago. I was born.
Yeah.
I went to art school, undergrad, years ago in Philadelphia. I became a designer in New York, did corporate identity and branding work. And back then, getting an MBA became a very well-known thing. And if you remember, right. Business Week came out with this ranking of the top business schools, and that became the hot thing. And so everybody's looking through that, and we're like, well, that would be a great next step. So I went off to business school because I really enjoyed the business side of things. When I was getting out of business school and I was interviewing with companies, no real company, serious company, wanted to hire the art guy. They couldn't quite figure out what to do with me. So I had to take the whole art thing, the design thing, and put it in the closet and just interview as the business guy.
But I can do spreadsheets. Honest, I can.
Right, right. Yeah. So I learned the spreadsheets and all that. So what I figured out, though, was a few years later, a lot of the solution development I was doing and I was doing with my team actually used those creative principles that we had used in design years before. So it wasn't just about here are the benchmarks and here's the answer, but it was about how do we start to use those principles about disaggregating the problem and divergent thinking and things like mm-hmm. that. So that became something that was is very important to us at Sales Globe, is design thinking to look at the problem differently. And as I had described it before, the benefit for our clients is that they get new solutions and new ideas they may not have thought of otherwise, versus, well, here's the benchmark, here's what somebody did in another company, how do we think about this differently? So design thinking for us, or sales design thinking as we call it, is a process where we go mm-hmm. through and we take the problem statement, as we talked about before, we look at the story behind that and redefine it as a challenge question. We take the challenge question, we look at the components of that challenge question and start to look for possible solutions to each of those components. So if we're trying to solve a problem around quotas, for an example, the problem statement might be around, we need to fix quotas. Our quota process is broken. But when you disaggregate it, you might find that it has something to do with certain geographies, certain segments, maybe parts of the organization that were involved, perhaps finance or marketing that were involved. So if you can tear that apart and you can break it into its components, you can start to find different options or different ideas for solutions.
He's kind of, it's a very simple process, right? But, and Mark put a lot out there. And the really interesting, cool thing that I'll say is, first of all, not only do we do that as consultants, we train our consultants inside to use design thinking, sales design thinking principles, but we also train our clients, right? We also give that knowledge transfer as they are building value propositions or trying to understand the needs of their clients. So if you think about it, it's really kind of not so hard, right? If you just take your problem statement and then restate your problem statement, I mean, it sounds really complicated, but it's really not. And then we do some parallel thinking. It sounds abstract, but I'll tell you, it's really not at the end of the day.
It actually seems pretty elegant. But I think that let me surmise a guess as to why that might be so powerful. Because if your clients knew how to do that already, they would have done it before calling you.
Right.
If they knew what the alternatives were, if they had more than the inspiration from last Sunday's golf show where they saw an ad for this particular technology or a golfer wearing that particular visor with a consultancy name on it, that's the inspiration for change, perhaps. But the application of it is much more complicated, and they've never done it before. So that's one of the inhibitors.
Right. So we do, it's a new way of thinking, right? Mark, it's a new muscle.
And that's a great metaphor. Mm. It's a new muscle. So you're basically building new creative muscle memory.
Yeah.
So
it's
as simple as taking whatever the thing is that you're trying to solve and asking questions about each of the key components of that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we talked about sales strategy before, and, you know, we need a new sales strategy. Well, what do we mean by sales strategy? What is a sales strategy?
Right.
So asking those questions and bringing in others to talk about that. We talk about bringing in the outsider as well. Bringing in others outside of your team to look at those ideas can expand thinking. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to just push beyond the obvious, because most organizations will get through the first few steps of solution development. They'll identify the problem statement. They'll do something they call brainstorming, right? And they'll all get together in a room with a lot of post-it notes and
pooling ignorance,
lot of stuff on the wall. And then what happens is after the brainstorming, they go off and they say, well, let's type all that up and then let's look at how we might develop or we might implement some of those ideas. And they miss this whole discovery process of let's go deeper and start to tear things apart.
Yeah.
You know, like our dear friends in Cupertino say, think different,
right?
Which is supposed to be differently, but that's okay. being a grammarian. No, that it is. It's taking them to a place they don't – it's not that they're unable. They just have never done it, right?
Right.
And you're telling me they are able because you can teach them how to do it. It's just, like you said, a new muscle, something they haven't yet experienced on their own.
Yeah. And, you know, once they do, it's a big aha moment. I mean, it really is. And we do it internally at Sales Globe. I was probably when I first started at Sales Globe years ago and I didn't know a lot about sales compensation. I was probably one of the best ones at this because I didn't know what I didn't know.
Right.
I was throwing out all kinds of stuff. And, you know, here I am 5 years later and I still do that. But, you know, it's okay. But it does once people start to think a little bit differently. What we have found, even our clients, right? They can't solve things the way that their competitors are because their clients are looking for differentiation or what's the real reason to change, you know, to buy from you as opposed to where I've been comfortable buying from.
Right.
So that's really why this is very powerful.
So if you take an example that you're referring to about sales compensation, there are plenty of left brain structures out there on how to do sales compensation or how to do sales role design, what have you. But if you can break some of those constraints, that makes a difference. So, you know, very simple example. If you take sales compensation, one of the principles of sales compensation is you pay for results, not activities. Some companies we've worked with, though, however, you find that the result is actually not the one thing you want to pay for. So we worked with a company in the beer business a few years ago, and what we found is that what drove beer sales through the retailer was not paying for cases or additional beer volume, paying the reps, but it was actually paying for the merchandising, paying for the marketing components that they could put in those stores. So we paid for activities, which then produced results, which was beer selling through the store. Right.
Right. Because results are always achieved through activities.
Isn't that interesting? Right. Yes.
But that would break one of the tenets of sales compensation.
Exactly.
Right? So you've got to break some. So you might say, well, what is it that actually drives that result we're looking for? Right. And then let's break some of those rules.
Yes.
Yeah. Because if you only pay on the results and then you restrict the activities, and obviously there are some legal, moral, ethical restrictions, obviously. Yeah. But if you start to then get over-regimented in the activities you're allowed to do or forced to do, you're actually working against your own outcomes.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's true. The biggest challenge with that project, though, Mark, is you and that team, you were drunk all the time. It was a real problem. But outside of that, it went extremely well.
That sounds like a lot of sales organizations I know. So it sounds like a really creative and innovative way, and getting people to think differently is absolutely a great idea. And obviously, you're getting the results you want from it. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other challenges that you see organizations facing today? You've touched on some of them with compensation and sales strategy. What are some of the other things, sales enablement things, that you're seeing businesses really struggle with today?
Well, I think one of the perennial ones is quota setting.
Okay.
Which is why we wrote the new book called Quotas. But it's
well named.
But it has an exclamation point on it.
It does. Okay. It does.
But one of the challenges, I think, is that quotas are a bit elusive in that we spend a lot of time on the incentive compensation plan, and at the end of the quarter, we say, we're going to go set quotas. So somebody will go set quotas in the conference room or in the boardroom, and they're done. When in fact, it really goes a lot deeper than that. You've got to understand the people components in terms of the dynamics of the team, the dynamics of the sales organization, and two very important counterbalancing factors, which is market opportunity and sales capacity. So quota setting, I think, is challenging because it just really is a new frontier for a lot of organizations. They haven't spent a lot of time on it. And the dynamic changes because it's not all about the sales organization with quotas, because you get heavy involvement from the finance organization,
right,
which tends to think a little bit differently than sales.
They think we want this much money. We have this many salespeople. Divide.
That's it.
And
that's
we'll either oversubscribe or undersubscribe.
Right. Yeah. You got the basic equation.
Right, right.
And then that does not always work. So that's a big area for us. With the book, we went into those major components that I just described, but we also used the design thinking approach. Yep. And the idea is, well, we could write a book about quota setting, but that wouldn't help people necessarily solve their problems. So what we did is we wrote a book about problem solving with quota setting as the object.
Okay.
And we're giving people a way to understand how to solve that problem with the tools that we're giving them for working on quotas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, as we said before, redefining the problem, divergent thinking, et cetera, applied to these building blocks of quotas around people, market opportunity, sales capacity. And with those tools, you can then solve the problem. So it just hasn't really been explored. It's one of those, as I said, next frontiers.
Yeah. And that human element and the market opportunity element are kind of really important attributes or components of the equation. Who needs to hear that message in your most client organizations? Who should be? So I'm going to point to the listeners here to get that person to buy your book for sure, because we know finance how they do it, but we also know sales ops gets involved, and there is a sales strategy around quota achievement. There's a cultural aspect to that how hard we want the whip to crack, or how easily we want it to be, you know, what a great place we want this to be to work. So there's a lot of other cultural elements that enter into this as well. So,
well, I think the key players need to really understand how this works, because when we did the research on it, and we knew this intuitively, you've got senior leadership. You have sales leadership, sales senior leadership. You have sales operations. Mm-hmm. You have the people in finance, of course. So they've got to understand how to work together. So I think it's important for them to understand how this whole process works.
So creating some teaming there.
Exactly.
Common exactly. outcomes, different yeah. different responsibilities coming together.
Right. So then take it to the other end. If you look at the field and you look at field sales management and even reps, understanding how their quotas are set and how they can get a better quota is very important to them as well. So not just getting the number, but how do I negotiate my number?
Right.
Not in a devious way, but no. how do I know the factors I should be considering when my leadership tells me, okay, here's your number. What should I come back with in terms of a response, and how do I build a logical argument? And then how do I understand how to go after and get that quota ultimately? So I think the book itself talks to several different audiences mm-hmm. from a leadership standpoint and a field standpoint.
Does it get into the compensation design as well, or is that something that you probably have to do? Because that's I've never met a salesperson, myself included, who didn't, the moment they got their comp plan, read it cover to cover and say, mm-hmm. how am I going to hit this?
Right.
Where can I trick it? How do I optimize this for my results? And so where does that come in?
The book focuses on quotas exclusively. Mm-hmm. We have another book we wrote a couple of years ago called What Your CEO Needs to Know About Sales Compensation that actually is the beginning point of that. So if you put those two together, it'd be a nice gift set, actually, for holidays. You put those two together, then you've
available
got both sides of the equation.
At a bookseller near you.
Right, right.
I'll tell you what, if you bundle it in with account planning, you can do an excellent 3-for-1 option there. But anyway. So the point that you just asked, right, the point that you just made, and very clear, Steve, you're right. They're inexplicably linked. You can build the best compensation plan known to man and known to anyone. But if the quotas aren't believed and they're not realistic,
right.
then yeah. So we just, it doesn't work.
Right.
You know, so we really do spend a lot of time, again, on change management, communications, proof sources, helping people understand how they're going to get there.
So communication is a critical aspect of everything I've heard today.
Yeah.
Because the reps want to believe the quota wasn't just, you know, a number on a dartboard, and that there's a reasonable chance they can actually come close to it or exceed it. You know, mm-hmm. nobody wants mm-hmm. – sure there are people out there who would love a gimme quota.
Yeah.
You know, it's exactly $10 less than I already plan on selling. But no, most people don't mind working for their quota, but they want to know it's achievable.
They do want to know it's achievable, yeah. So this comes down again to the proof sources, right, and the data analytics showing them what it is. So truly understanding, Mark talked about when you set your quota – you're looking at market as well as capacity, right? So it's more than just here's the number. If they look at the market opportunity, we're talking about white space opportunity that they mm-hmm. can truly penetrate, and explaining to them how green space, new logo business, like where is it and how do you get it, right? If that's the expectation of that role. And then balancing that against the capacity, in other words, how much we know you can sell. How many hours do you have, and how does that translate into revenue dollars that you have to sell? And so you need to give them, though, the proof source and data behind it, right?
Right.
And then we also like to show when you're changing a plan, and even if it's a really good plan, what we typically will do is we'll show them an example of a deal. Here was your plan last year, and here's what would happen under the new plan, so that they really do understand, you know, how it would pay and benefit them at the end of the day.
So that is that's chapter 10 of the book, which Ooh. Is making change.
Yes.
And so we get into that after you've done all this work. How do you mm-hmm. introduce to the organization? Mm-hmm. And one piece at the end that Michelle is describing is what we call the communications campaign. Mm-hmm. So it encapsulates a lot of those areas we've been talking about, which is your audiences, your key messages, mm-hmm. your proof sources, your vehicles and learning modes. So it sounds like a lot, but when you do that for a program like quota setting or like a new sales organization or the change in the sales compensation program, that will, to a very large degree, make it more successful as a program in implementation.